Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Talk radio across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning, welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on the home of Common Sense. It is the one and only Talk Radio. The dust has settled this morning on the euphoria created at the Tory party conference yesterday by Boris Johnson, who's loving with his own government. His performance was flawless. The jokes were unending, and the attacks on Labour and Starmer Chameleon went down a treat. We're going to stick with Starmer Chameleon because I rather like it. But as I was saying to Julia Hartley Brewer, that's not all it takes to make a country great, is it? This morning, there are a few dissenting voices stirring, some of them from the world of business who aren't happy about being blamed for shortages in the supply chain, in the workforce and in the transportation business. And as I predicted yesterday, they're not happy about suddenly being told that the UK is moving to a high-wage, low-tax economy without there being a heavy knock-on effect to their own profits. The bottom line is that the Prime Minister has set out his stall for a new vision of Britain, but is it achievable? Is it realistic? And can he convince business that it is actual economic possibility? We'll be asking Henry Hill from Conservative Home what he makes of it all, of course. 03444991000. We also want to hear from you, because if you are in the never again Boris camp, if you are one of those people who doesn't think the Tory party has done what it said on the tin that they said they would do when they won the election in 2019, then we want to hear from you. Has he put Britain on a collision course with success and riches at the end of the road? In which case, why wouldn't you vote for him? Because in the end, surely, to be optimistic, as I often say, is a far better place to live than in the land of doom and gloom where everything's terrible and it's all down to Brexit and we're never going to be a successful country on our own. I don't believe that. You don't believe that. We want to believe in Britain. We want Britain to be great, but we want it also to be fair. 03444991000. Of course, coming up, we'll be getting the latest on the energy crisis as bills look set to soar and double in some cases this winter. Gas has hit a record high in trading. What is going on? How are people going to be able to afford their energy bills? We'll also bring you up to date with the Prince Andrew lawsuit as his representatives seek to squash the case from Virginia Giuffre altogether. Helen Dale's also here with her take on the cult of personality that makes Boris Johnson so successful despite his many missteps. Just what is his secret, you might well ask? And Simon Calder is checking under the bonnet on the latest travel arrangements, because another 32 countries have been taken off the no-go list, and we'll see whether we can actually start going places. 03444991000. Because it's Thursday, it's time for Helen and Nicholas and the Thursday Club. She's bringing a selection of reds today for our delectation. I'm not quite sure where they're coming from, but I'm sure they will be delicious. It's not a particularly great day out there. It's looking a bit grey. Andy Murray's lost his wedding ring, by the way, so if anybody's seen it, would you mind giving us a call and we'll pass it on to him. 03444991000. You listen to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Front page this morning of The Times. PM hit by business backlash. Pro-Brexit bosses insist firms cannot be treated like a sponge to soak up rising costs. And what we do know about inflation is that it is a rather insidious problem. Lots of people don't notice until it's too late. That lots of people don't realise is upon them until it is upon them. Let's talk now to Henry Hill, news editor of Conservative Home, because we'll see how the Conservative movement has taken to Boris Johnson's speech yesterday, which was in by no means a bad speech. It was a brilliant speech in so many ways. It was very funny. He had the audience in the palm of his hand. He made some great jokes about Keir Starmer. He made some very funny references to some members of his own government. And he was probably giving one of his best performances ever. But is it enough? Henry Hill, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
I guess that is the $64,000 question, isn't it? Is it enough? Is it going to work? And is he has he done anything more than simply impress the sort of the Tory faithful at a conference?
Well, it always, I mean, basically, a leader's speech at a conference is an opportunity to get it wrong. If you manage to get through the whole thing without creating headlines for making a big mistake or costing a sort of visible show of division, you've basically done the job. It's very rare that they make a positive difference in the other direction. This time, I think, is no different. Boris has always been a very good speech maker. It was a very good speech as a sort of technical, as a technical example of the craft. The members loved it. He's currently ahead in the polls. Of course, they're happy. But I think the thing that a lot of commentators are picking up today, and the business backlash, I think, is part of this, is that he skated over all the actual difficult questions raised by his agenda. He wants to be a high-wage economy, fine. But how do you do that without becoming a high-price economy, right, fueling inflation? He wants to give young people the opportunity to own their own homes, but he also said that levelling up is actually about preventing people in Stoke Poges having their views ruined by new houses. So everywhere you see these contradictions, and good as he is in the hall, I don't know how you overcome those.
No, quite. But I think that is part of the problem, isn't it? Because we're now being told that the narrative that we should be listening to is that we've become addicted to kind of cheap labour from the European Union, that we've somehow had a low price economy. And I'm not quite sure who they're talking to, because I don't know anyone that thinks Britain's cost of living is particularly low. And it hasn't been for quite some few years, certainly not in the southeast of England. You know, I don't feel as if I'm living in a cheap country. But we're now told that we're going to have to give up on that and everything's going to cost us more money.
Well, I think it's the case, absolutely, that you know, one of the big drivers of Brexit was the way that the European Union allowed businesses to import labour from countries where it was cheaper rather than increasing British wages. And that's a completely legitimate argument. But it is simply sort of a brute fact of economic reality that if you substitute cheaper labour for more expensive labour, at several points through the supply chain, you know, in the shops, in the field, in the farmers' fields, driving the trucks, and all of that gets more expensive, that those price those cost increases will feed through to prices that you and me pay at the end of the day, which is why typically back in the bad old days, you know, high wage demands, fuel price increases, and that's what led to inflation. Now, it's up to the nation what balance we want to strike between that. But I think it's important that none of us pretend that there is no potential downside to what Boris Johnson is doing.
Because one of the things he didn't mention yesterday, unless I missed it, was the rise in national insurance that's going to hit everybody next April, when people are going to be paying minimum 1.25% more and possibly in some cases 2.5% more. And that's going to hit people quite hard as well.
Absolutely. And this is another huge tension at the heart of what Boris Johnson wants to do. On, you know, on the one hand, he talks about high wages. There's talk of a cost of living crisis, which he wants to deal with. Fine. But on the other hand, quite a few of his policies are going to involve more costs to us. And it's not just the tax increase, although I think, you know, given that social care is a vastly huge, expensive policy problem, we can only expect the social care, the special social care levy to go up and up. But it's also things like net zero. If you look at net zero, how do you hit it? An awful lot of the policies involve increasing prices on energy, increasing prices on things like meat, potentially, and all sorts of other essentials. And this is riven all the way through. If you want to have a, if you want to be driving down the cost of living as much as possible, you try and make those things cheaper, not more expensive. And again, he's a very good showman. And in the hall, he's very convincing. But where, how he's going to reconcile these completely divergent ambitions is anyone's guess.
Yeah, I mean, I got the sense yesterday that Boris was trying to sort of convince everyone that we're entering a new era, not just of conservatism, but of his government and of Britain, really, that there's a new Britain somewhere out there that we need to try and create and to achieve in a way. But I wonder whether what he actually did yesterday was to signal how out of touch a lot of politicians have become from the ordinary working men and women of the country.
Well, I mean, it's all. I mean, that's a charge that's as old as the hills, isn't it? I think it's.
Definitely, yeah, but it's particularly showing, but it's particularly relevant now, I think, because it does seem more and more that those people in power don't really quite understand the little people.
I think what the reason it's showing up more is because this new Conservative Party that Boris Johnson is trying to set up is very volubly and sort of symbolically trying to be on their side. You know, as long as I've been covering politics, the political class in many senses has been cut off from ordinary people. I mean, if you think back to what originally drove the Brexit vote 10 years ago, the debate on immigration, they were completely cut off. But I think there's a real tension now because Boris Johnson is saying, look, this is a new Conservative Party. You know, I've won the red wall. I'm now on the side of working families. I'm going to be dry. I'm going to keep your costs down, increasing your wages. But then so much of his party, and his government is still running on this other agenda, which is very SW1, you know, which I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but that is tax increases. That is new taxes on bad things. That is higher costs. And so the question is, does he eventually, he's going to have to choose. He's going to have to choose whether to lean in to his new electorate and start pushing the cost of living down, even if that means trimming his sales in other areas, or to lean into his, you know, SW1 agenda, even if that means imposing higher costs on ordinary people.
Yeah, because when you see the hall, the body of the hall yesterday, and I don't know if you were at the conference or at that, indeed, at that speech, but when you see, you know, Carrie Simmons sitting next to Rachel Johnson, Boris's sister, Henry Newman, the, you know, the chief advisor in Downing Street that has been very good friends of hers, and you know that these people are not worried about paying an extra £1,000 a year for their electricity, which many people are going to be faced with doing.
No, I know, and this is one of the, and this is as I said, I agree with you. I think this is a big problem that the government has, and you know, the danger for the Tories is always that the public start to think that they're not on people's, they're not on your side, they're not on our side. This is always a dangerous question. It's very easy for Labour to lead on this question. And I think one of the reasons that Boris Johnson got his breakthrough majority is, for once, loads of people who wouldn't normally consider voting Conservative thought, yeah, no, that guy, actually, I know he's posh, I know he went to Eton, that doesn't really matter. That guy understands my concerns, and he's there to represent me and to champion my interests. And I think it would be very dangerous if he moved away from that agenda, because then, you know, all of the poshness and stuff, which is currently bouncing off because ultimately voters care about what you're doing, that will suddenly become very toxic, could become very toxic if he were delivering this agenda that was just pushing up prices for people who don't live like he does.
Right, exactly. And what of the gas crisis? I mean, the gas price hit a record high yesterday. We know that the Russians have now apparently released a bit more gas to Europe, but I'm told also that Qatar is a problem at the moment because they're selling all their gas to China. And we have left ourselves sort of marooned, and it's not a Brexit issue as such, but it's an issue that governments all the way back probably to Blair and Brown really didn't prepare us for the modern energy age.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the most frustrating thing about this for anyone who's read up on energy policy is that, you know, there was a proposal that was being touted around Whitehall for about 10 years to build up a bridge, to build a strategic gas reserve for the UK. And basically what that is it's a big tank, or a series of tanks that you can store about 3 months gas in. And then if there's a short-term crunch like we're in now, you can just draw down on it to ease shortages while you find alternatives. Mm. And then when the crisis eases, you can build it back up. Now, the man who was trying to get eventually just gave up because governments were addicted to this kind of very efficient, just-in-time supply line model. Again, a bit like the European Union with manufacturing. You know, they were like, we'll build very efficient ways of getting gas here so that we don't have to invest any money in building up this strategic reserve. But of course, that is fine until something goes wrong. Yeah. And then the moment something goes wrong, we're left like this. So I think hopefully the lesson for the British government is stop being so totally averse to spending money. If you're willing to keep, you know, whacking taxes up, at least spend some of it on infrastructure that's going to pay off for 10, 20 years and avoid scenes like this.
Well, I mean, you can't accuse them of not spending money, really, can you? Because they've spent an awful lot of money in the last year or so. But quite a lot of it has been completely thrown. They might as well have burned it on a bonfire, mightn't they?
Well, I mean, I think that's broadly my point. You know, the British government is not averse to spending money, but there's this weird mindset where they will just hose money at, you know, ongoing costs and waste and all the rest of it. But when it comes to making investments, not politician investments, which is just spending, but genuine investments, you know, buying something and building something that will last for 10 or 20 years, they're just completely averse. That's where they make the savings. They trim down on, you know, railway lines and all this stuff that would have a long-term dividend to the nation in order to make up for the fact that they're complete spendthrifts in other areas. Mm. It's not a sustainable way to proceed.
And what is Boris Johnson's secret? I mean, you've been covering the Conservative Party, Henry, for quite a long time. You've seen different leaders come and go. I mean, he does seem to have an incredible ability to not so much make people forget what he said before, but just kind of ignore himself what he said before and ignore exactly some things that he's done before as if they never happened. And he gets away with it every time.
His whole persona diffuses an awful lot of the things that normally trip politicians up because he owns it. And, you know, we everyone has an opinion about whether or not that should work. But the fact of the matter is that he sort of doesn't pretend that he's not who he is in that regard. And so when you catch him in a lie or whatever, it's just priced in. Whereas, you know, if it was David Cameron or someone who made a big sort of solemn statement about something and then it turned out to be complete nonsense, that would be very embarrassing for him. But for Boris Johnson, it's not. A lot of people like the act. A lot of people like being entertained. It's not as if seriousness is always a virtue in a politician. And it's an incredible performance that he's managed to put together. I think there is a problem that once things do start going wrong, eventually the public will get tired of it. But for the moment, they haven't. And, you know, he's currently taking a party through a fuel crisis and has stayed ahead in the polls. It's remarkable.
It really is remarkable. I mean, it's not probably unhindered by the fact that Sir Keir Starmer, Starmer Chameleon, as he's going to now forever be known, is so useless.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Conservative Party has been playing politics on easy mode since, what, 2010? Because the Labour Party keep just selecting a truly miserable selection of leaders. Now, I think obviously Keir's better than what's come before, but the fact of the matter is that, judging by Labour's conference, they're still not really in a place where they're serious about winning the next election. You know, it's fine, he's made some progress, he's got some sort of... But, you know, I was watching Sir Keir Starmer's speech, and the main thing I was just thinking was, you know, there were promises of money, there were promises not to break promises, there were promises of independent targets, but there's no programme. Labour still don't know what to do with this new Conservative Party. They want to be running against the Thatcherite caricature that they were running against in the 90s and noughties, and they don't know how to handle Boris Johnson.
No, that's true, which again, I suppose, is what he has proven himself to be very good at. I mean, Diane Abbott today, I think, put out a tweet saying that it's still the case that more Labour members actually prefer Jeremy Corbyn as leader than Keir Starmer. They still think that he's a more popular figure. And as long as they've got that going on, they're never getting anywhere, are they?
Well, I think that specific figure was ignored the unpopularity figure. So I don't think in net Jeremy Corbyn was more popular. But yeah, absolutely. Labour is a deeply divided party.
Yeah.
And the problem for Keir Starmer is that the more he tries to put meat on the bones of a kind of realistic programme for government, the more he's going to aggravate the left. And the other specific problem for him, which we saw last week, is that one of the easiest things to pivot on for Labour, if you're trying to be serious, is law and order. That's one of the swing issues that, you know, either party could own in the right circumstances. And you'd think, as a former Crown prosecutor, he'd be all over that. But it just so happens the week of his conference is the week that we had this the latest Wayne Cousins Sarah Everard scandal. And instead of doing the very obvious thing for an opposition politician to do, which is eviscerate the government for failing to take action and demand that the Metropolitan Police Commissioner be dismissed, he defended Cressida Dick as a former colleague.
Right.
With political instincts like that, it's hard to see how they get anywhere.
Yeah, precisely right. Henry, stay with us for a moment, if you would. We're just going to take a little short break. I want to talk to you about what this means for Boris Johnson's legacy, where he goes from here, and when it starts to all go wrong, how will we know? What will be the signal?
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We're talking to Henry Hill, news editor of Conservative Home, about Boris Johnson, whether his legacy will be that he did recreate Britain in his own image, and he did make it into this sort of green and pleasant land with an emphasis on green and an emphasis on high wages and an emphasis on happy people. Jacqueline says, I was really annoyed with Boris up until his speech yesterday. I voted Brexit to drive up wages and make it more beneficial to get a job and not have to choose benefits first. I also accept we will have to pay more, but surely that's better for the economy. People should have an incentive to take a job, and then once they can work, they can train to get further up the ladder. But the first run had to be a step that doesn't create insecurity. We need to get more kids into apprenticeships, and I think he wants to do that. What I wanted to ask you, Henry, was if it does start to go wrong, when will we know, as it were? And I know that sounds a bit simplistic, but what do you think will be the first sign or the first signal that whatever this strategy is not working?
Ooh, what a question. Yeah. I obviously hesitate to prognosticate, but I think basically you will probably start seeing the cracks appear in the Conservative Party, because there is a big tension at the moment. It was skated over at the conference, but there is a big tension between the Prime Minister, you know, people who think like the Prime Minister, who were like, we were elected on this quite high spending agenda, we've got to fulfill our promises to our voters and so on. And then you've got people who are like the Chancellor, who say, you know, no matter really what we were elected on in 2019, the fact is that we've just spent vast sums of public money on the pandemic.
Yeah.
And what we need to do now is retrench, because otherwise all of the arguments that we made a decade ago about, you know, passing on debt to our children and spending vast amounts of public money servicing that debt and everything else are going to come back to bite us. Now, at the moment, Boris Johnson's skating along, and that's fine. But there are nonetheless, over the next few years, there's going to be very, very difficult decisions for the Conservative Party to make. And I think the big one is tax rises, because Rishi Sunak is a fiscal conservative, which is not the same thing as a low tax conservative.
Physically, he's quite prepared to balance the books with tax rises rather than spending cuts if that's what's necessary, and that's what's happening so far. Now, you know, that national insurance contribution increase was not uncontroversial, but if it's only the first of many, if the social care levy or whatever we're calling it continues to go up, if other taxes are levelled on working class people, on working age people, then the question is, even if you are earning more tax, you know, this is the flip side of the high wage economy, right? It's no good pushing people's wages up if at the same time a graduate in their early to mid 20s is facing a marginal tax rate north of 50%. If you're taking it all back again, they're not going to feel better off and they're not going to reward you. So I think that's what Boris Johnson needs to focus on.
Yes.
It's not enough just to push up wages. It's to bring up take home pay. And that's a very difficult question.
Well, it's the age-old sort of Reaganomics thing, isn't it? You know, we should be able to keep more money than the government takes off us. And if the government starts to take more money off you than you've got for yourself, then they're doing it wrong. And basically, they should leave people to make their own decisions about what money they choose to spend. But Liz Truss is quite an interesting figure in this as well, isn't it? Because she apparently is against increasing tax. And she now emerges as a possible next leader. So that's quite an interesting dynamic in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Liz Truss being elevated to foreign secretary was maybe one of the most interesting moves in the reshuffle. Mm. It means that, you know, alongside Rishi Sunak, there's now another person in the cabinet who is being talked about as a potential leader of the Conservative Party. And as you say, she's a low tax conservative. Now, everyone says they are at conference. Even the Chancellor said that he was. But she's a very specific kind, which is that people like Liz Truss, Kwasi Kwarteng, the business secretary, they're prepared to fund tax cuts with borrowing. They're prepared to cut taxes on the basis that it will, as you say, increase take-home pay, spur growth, and in the short to medium term, just absorb that hit by borrowing the money. Mm. Rishi Sunak's not prepared to do that. Now, I think if you're looking for a retail politics offer, let's cut your taxes and not take it anywhere else is obviously quite a good one. It's one that people have been doing for years, and it's created some of our current problems. But I think that will be interesting if the Chancellor is pushing Boris Johnson to balance the books by pushing up taxes. It opens up the danger for Boris that the low tax wing of his party suddenly gets this gifted, this issue, this very obvious attack line that they can use to attack him as and when things start going south.
Yes. Well, we'll keep a very close eye on it with your help, Henry. Thank you very much indeed. Henry Hill, news editor of Conservative Home. I don't think there's any doubt that people who are impressed by Boris Johnson's rhetoric, who are impressed by his bluster, and even those who are not, would have to admit that yesterday's speech was probably one of the best he's ever given. However, is it, as Henry Hill says, simply a set piece kind of piece of theatre, if you like, for the Tories in the Parliament and the Tories in that room, in that particular auditorium, to listen to his view of the future? I don't have an objection to his view of the future. I don't have a problem with not building houses on greenbelt land. I don't have a problem with making sure that people get more money for a decent day's work. I don't have a problem with any of that. But I do have a problem with paying more tax. I do have a problem with not expecting any of that to have a knock-on effect on the price. I also have a massive problem with the way the energy prices are currently going. We're going to be talking about those coming up shortly. Because if you're having a ridiculously accelerated energy bill, I want to hear from you. We've been talking about this for a long time. We started talking about energy before anybody else did. And so now it has come to pass. What we said was going to happen has happened, only worse than we ever thought possible.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let's talk now, though, to John Bosco Nwobo, campaigns officer at We Own It, because let me tell you this, even I have been affected by this massive energy increase of price, because the so-called electricity bill for my gaff is going to go from 900 quid to 1900 quid in the space of 1 year alone. And in fact, the increase has been predicted in the space of 6 months. So let's find out from John Bosco what on earth is going on. John Bosco, welcome back. Very good morning to you.
Very good morning to you, Mike, and to your viewers.
Thank you very much for joining us. I mean, this is turning into a massive nightmare. Every time I'm getting lots of texts from people and tweets from people saying every time they get a communication from their electricity company or their energy company, the price has gone up again. And it's another estimate for what they're going to have to be paying. I know that there's been a cap lifted and there's going to be a new cap lifted possibly in the new year. I mean, this can't go on like this, can it?
It cannot go on like this. And thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to kind of be part of this discussion.
Yes.
Well, you might. The last time we spoke was a few months ago when Ofgem, the regulator of energy prices, allowed energy companies to increase prices by about £139. And you might remember then I did mention that this would push about 500,000 households into fuel poverty. And of course, now we are talking about potential increases of more than £500.
Yes.
Right. So this is catastrophic. And I was wondering, Mike, if you knew how many people died, excess mortality rate during the winter of 2019-2020. According to the Office of National Statistics, that number is over 23,000.
I'm slightly dubious about that particular statistic, John Bosco. I'm not saying that that people aren't dying because of the cold, but it seems to me that there's probably more to it than that. Do you know what I mean? And I appreciate that it's a figure that a lot of people use, but I think it's a misleading figure, and I think we're better off looking at the prices of things rather than the numbers of people dying of stuff.
I think that you may have a point, but I also actually think that that statistic is correct for a number of reasons. The people who produce the statistics, the Office of National Statistics, are actually really careful to take into account all the other possible factors that go into people dying. So these are actually really over 20,000 of our grandparents, of people we know in our communities, that are dying from the cold. And this kind of also takes into account the fact that people are also dying from COVID, right? So it's an incredible situation that people are facing down right now. And it seems to me that the government isn't doing enough to deal with this problem. I think that the fact that a lot of hundreds of thousands of families across the country right now are having to deal with potential price hikes because their energy producer is a small company that is going to go out of business as a result of this crisis. And the government isn't stepping in to create a publicly owned energy supply company to hoover up all of those customers and make sure that they're stabilized, that their prices don't go out of hand, and all of that. Those are the problems that people face right now that the government could be solving in the immediate term, that the government isn't doing anything about.
Yeah, but what could the government do, John Bosco, short of kind of nationalizing or renationalizing energy?
Well, in the very short term, the government could create an energy supply, a publicly owned energy supply company, right? So essentially, it could say, well, here are these 40 small energy companies that are likely going bust as a result of this crisis. What we are going to do is we're going to transfer all of their customers to one single publicly owned energy supply company. And we're going to invest in this company to make sure that the prices of energy don't go out of hand for those customers. Right now, what's happening is that those people are being transferred to the big six companies. And of course, in some cases, the big six companies don't want these people because they tend to be quite vulnerable customers and people who may not be able to cover their bills, right? And in many cases, the big six companies respond to this by increasing the price of energy for these people, right? So I think the government can step in the short term and create a publicly owned energy supply company to deal with this. But in the long term, public ownership of the entire energy infrastructure is the only answer that we think will work. Energy producers and suppliers make about 1.2 billion, I think in 2020, they made about 1.2 billion pounds in profits for their operations. And that money, if invested into our energy infrastructure and not going out into the pockets of private companies, could really go toward reducing people's energy bills by some estimates by up to 37%, right? So instead of hiking energy bills, we could actually be bringing them down. Crisis or no crisis, I think the big problem here is that private companies are ensconced in the system and make it a point to extract profits from the system. Whereas if it's run by the government, if it's run publicly, all of the profits from supplying and producing energy would be reinvested into cutting people's fare, into cutting people's energy bills, and moving toward a renewable energy infrastructure in the future.
But we also know, John Bosco, that renewables have cost us an awful lot of money, and one of the reasons why we are where we are is because of government's previous and current obsession with renewable energy, because Ofgem is run now by a guy who used to work for the Department of Climate Change. You know, he's very much bought into this whole green production line, and part of the also reason for a huge energy cost in this country to individual consumers and to homeowners is the green part of the green subsidy that they have to pay. So, you know, if they got rid of that, they'd probably reduce people's bills by quite a significant amount as well.
No, I don't think so at all, Mike.
Tell me, John Bosco, how much people pay on average as a percentage of their bill for the green subsidy?
Well, I think, let me just make a general point first, if you don't mind, Mike. I think that the more, and actually, as a whole, renewable energies cost people less than fossil fuels. And the reason for that, of course, is that we don't actually have to go to some far off country, extracted and transported by sea.
You don't have to do that if you have fracking either. You can get shale gas up in Blackpool. You don't have to go anywhere.
Well, fracking is not costless either, right? Because it has actual environmental impact.
No, I know, but you've just told me that we can't use fossil fuels because it costs a lot to ship it here. Well, this stuff doesn't cost anything to ship here. It's already here.
Yeah, but it also has other costs.
Yes, but we can't afford it, John Bosco, you know? I mean, this is not an argument I'm having with you. I'm having an argument with the government because we can't afford to pay for their dream of a green economy. We can't afford it.
But the point I'm making to you is that the more we expand green energy, the cheaper it costs. It's costly at the moment because we have not done it at scale. And if we invest in our energy infrastructure and increase the scale of it, the evidence from across the world is that renewable energies cost significantly less.
Well, except the beginning of this crisis, John Bosco, was caused by the fact that we didn't have enough wind. And so we didn't have enough energy provided by wind turbines because the wind wasn't strong enough. That was what we were told. So it doesn't matter how many wind turbines you have. If you haven't got enough wind, you don't have enough energy.
Private companies who are currently running much of our energy supply and generation and supply are not investing enough in a diverse range of renewable sources of energy.
Why are we subsidizing them then?
Well, I don't know why we are subsidizing them. I think that the government should take them all into
Can you answer that original question then? How much by percentage do we pay in this subsidy? How much of my £1,900 electricity bill, which I'm going to be paying in the next year, is going to go to the subsidy?
I'm not entirely sure. It may be about 1 or 2%, if I'm not mistaken. But I don't think it's an awful lot. And I think it's a very good investment.
Well, if you don't know the answer, I'm not going to take that as an answer, John Bosco.
Well, I've not looked at those figures in a while.
Well, it would be helpful to know. I suspect it's a lot more than 1 or 2%.
I don't think so at all. But of course, you can have me on some other time to chat about that.
Okay.
But what I want to say is that the government could do a lot more to help families cut energy bills by taking the private companies that are currently extracting profits from our energy infrastructure into public ownership. But I think that way we could cut energy bills for families, and we could actually reinvest into our energy and make renewable energies cheaper for people. That's not where we are right now, because we're not investing enough in renewable energy.
Yes, but that's an argument that's kind of theoretical, isn't it? You're basically saying that it will become cheaper if we invest more money in it publicly, if the people of this country who already can't afford their energy pay even more of a subsidy to make sure that most of our energy comes from renewable sources. And that's a very long way off before it becomes cheap enough for everybody to afford. What are they supposed to do in the meantime?
No, it's not a theoretical argument at all. Evidence from across the world suggests that renewable energies are cheaper than
Which country would you say, John Bosco, we should look to that uses renewable energy solely and is cheap? Because I don't know of any.
I wouldn't say that any country uses renewable energies solely, but there are countries like Germany that generate a great amount of their energy from renewable energies, and where it is actually quite cheap. But the point I'm
like, how much do you pay for electricity in a year in Germany then in a three bedroom house?
Well, I lived in Germany for about 4 months, and from my experience, it was actually significantly lower than I pay for energy here right now. I would say about 30 or so percent lower than I pay now. So right. I think that it's a clear model that we could actually utilize.
One of the reasons, of course, for that as well is that they have a great deal more storage of gas than we have, don't they?
I don't think that that is what's at the heart of the issue. At the heart of the issue is the fact that private energy generators and suppliers extract billions of pounds in profits from our energy system. That is money that if it went back into our energy system, instead of being sucked out in profits, could actually go toward reducing energy prices for families today, this morning, instead of being allowed to go out into the pockets of individuals.
Yes. I don't think it's... But that, I don't think that's necessarily... We're going to have to stop it here, John Bosco. A very interesting conversation. Thank you for joining us. We'll come back to you again another time because there's lots more questions that I have about the way that we do all of this. John Bosco Nwobo there from the campaign We Own It, because he wants to change it all so that the public owns the utility, which is, and I'm not necessarily against, but it's not always the evil capitalists that are to blame. Because you look to the United States of America, where private companies all own the energy there, and it's a hell of a lot cheaper than it is here.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Right now, though, we're going to talk about the peak that we may have reached with climate madness. You know, those Insulate Britain people, funnily enough, haven't been back since they got roughed up down Millwall Way and also over on Wandsworth Bridge. I wonder if that was the final denouement for those idiots to say, we're very, very sorry and we're never going to do it again. Well, good. And if it means that the only way to take action against these people is to take action against them, that means it can't be a bad thing. The latest madness, right? You're not going to believe this, is from the British Medical Journal, in which doctors are being told to cut back on medical testing for things like cancer in order, guess what, to tackle climate change. That's right. I'm afraid they don't want you to be using too many tests. They don't want you to be trying to find out whether people are going to get a disease which is going to kill them, because we need to save the planet. I mean, I really do wonder what is going on in these people's heads. The British Medical Journal, the BMJ, is supposed to be something sensible. It's supposed to be an organ of what you might describe as common sense, but it clearly has gone to the dark side because they've written an editorial which in fact says that the biggest crisis facing the world's health is climate. Not cancer, not COVID, but climate. Jason Reed is here. He's the head of Young Voices. Jason, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
I mean, there are times when I kind of see things and go, well, you know, this is just the woke being a bit daft. But this is mad. This is literally crazy.
It's completely bonkers. It just goes to show you can't trust the public health lobby. They'll say or do anything that they think makes them sound good. You said in your intro that this might be the peak of climate change insanity. I'm afraid I don't agree. I think we're a long way off the peak. There's a lot more, further that they can go, and we just have to wait and see what comes next. But this is a whole new level of bonkers, isn't it? Perhaps I missed the memo, but I thought the point of fighting climate change was that we're protecting the planet so that we have somewhere to live in 100, 200 years' time. But if we've all died because we haven't got our cancer treatment on time, then what's the point in protecting the planet? There'll be no people left.
Well, that's right.
To live in it.
And one of the things they talk about is the NHS England launch of a campaign to tackle climate health emergency by becoming net zero, because they were going to start using a lot less plastic. Well, that hasn't gone too well during a COVID pandemic, has it? Because everything that they have provided, from PPE to masks to all sorts of other bits and pieces, are all made of plastic.
Well, exactly. And cutting down on plastic waste is one of these, again, it's just a virtue signalling talking point used by these people. Roughly 90% of the plastic in the ocean comes from 10 rivers, which are all in Africa and Asia. Britain, in terms of population, we're a small country and we're relatively good at recycling our plastic. We're not contributing in any meaningful way to any kind of plastic pollution. And so this kind of thing is just about being seen to take action or being seen to do something that's good and selfless. But of course, it's not selfless, because it will, first of all, it will cost a lot more. So that national insurance increase that we're all paying an extra bit of money to go into the NHS, that will go on to all of these sustainable bamboo cups and straws that they're going to be using now.
I'm not even sure if you can drink out of bamboo. I mean, I know you can make socks out of it, but I'm not entirely certain if you put something of a liquid nature into a bamboo cup that it's not just going to melt, is it?
Well, perhaps the NHS are the best people to answer that question.
Well, they probably are. But how about this, right? This is what they've actually said in this editorial. Over successive years, we've been told to continually lower our threshold for suspecting cancer, and we're encouraged to investigate sooner and more extensively. You know, like as if that's a bad thing, right? Patients with mildly elevated platelet counts now undergo a barrage of investigations to determine if cancer is the cause. Shouldn't we be considering the environmental impact of putting so many patients on a conveyor belt of investigations as part of a cost-benefit calculation? Well, they're basically saying we shouldn't be testing too many people for cancer because it's bad for the planet.
It's completely bonkers. I think it's also really insensitive in the aftermath of a pandemic where, of course, we all know about the huge NHS waiting lists and the backlog and people who really have not got the treatment and the testing that they needed when they needed it. And to be saying to those people now, not only is this a temporary situation where because of the pandemic your treatment was delayed and that cost a lot of lives, but now we're going to be stopping giving you that treatment altogether because we're worried that it might affect climate change in some marginal way. And my concern is that with the government that we have at the moment, which calls itself Conservative, they might buy into some of this stuff. Boris Johnson used to be a libertarian once upon a time, but now we're seeing tax increases, we're seeing the growth of the nanny state. And on the climate issue in particular, we've got COP26 coming up, the big conference in Glasgow, in which he's going to be showing off to the world and to Joe Biden in particular. They don't seem to be aware of the cost of net zero in the time frame that they want for everyday consumers, for you and I. And so they're going to be, it's entirely possible that they will be really seriously considering this kind of completely bonkers policy, which will have repercussions for decades to come.
And it seems to me it's also a good example of something we see a lot of now, Jason, which is the kind of use of experts in a field in which they're not actually experts. For example, the health field, where they're using environmental experts from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and the University of Washington in Seattle. Now, I'm sure it's very good if you're an expert in environmental matters, but it doesn't make you an expert on cancer. So therefore, you shouldn't be used as somebody to have a view on whether more cancer tests are a good idea or not.
Exactly. I think we've got to the point now where environmentalism is seen as such a universal good that absolutely everyone can contribute to it, and no matter what the cost is. Of course, if the British Medical Journal really cared about getting to net zero as quickly as possible, what they should be doing is campaigning for things like nuclear power or campaigning against China building a new coal-powered station every 5 minutes.
Yes.
Those are the things that really are having an impact on the planet and really are increasing our emissions. But the fact that they're focusing locally, they're focusing on the NHS, which is possibly the worst possible area to focus in terms of the costs that these kind of measures will bring about, just shows that they don't care about the climate at all. They only care about having their name in the British Medical Journal so that people can see, oh my goodness, what a good and selfless person you are, saving the planet.
Yeah, and what is that all about? Because, you know, I've been around this planet a bit longer than you, Jason, but I've never been in a period of time where people are so intensely worried about what other people think about them.
It's this modern virtue signalling age, isn't it? And I don't think it's even a political thing. We're seeing on all sides of the political spectrum, people care much more about the short-termist impression of what they're doing than about what the actual substantive policy debate is about. And this is a good example of why the government is not in a good position to fight something like climate change, because climate change is a long-term issue. And so if you're the kind of person who you're thinking, well, I might not be in government in 5 or 10 years' time, so I don't really care about what the actual impact will be of this policy I'm proposing, because I'll be raking it in the private sector by then. So you can do things that grab nice headlines, like banning plastic straws, which have no impact whatsoever on saving the planet, but they look good for you and they do good things for your CV. And in the short term, that's all that matters.
Yes. And I suppose this will be the first of many such statements of intent from various organisations ahead of this COP26 thing, where they're all trying to jump on the bandwagon and make more brownie points for themselves.
Exactly. Yeah, I can't see this getting any better. It's only going to get worse, both between now and COP26, which is next month in November, and after that as well, because supposedly they're going to set the agenda for climate change for the future. And if the agenda consists of warped thinking like this, that banning plastic straws in hospitals is going to be how we save the planet, then I'm afraid we have a lot more of this to come.
I'm afraid so. Jason, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Jason Reid, the head of Young Voices. But it really is bonkers, mad, crazy, as he says, for these people who are supposed to be health professionals. The British Medical Journal is supposed to be an expertly put together magazine for the health business, right? And for them to say, in this day and age, when we suffer bigger cancer numbers now than ever, people who haven't been diagnosed as a result of the COVID pandemic, if they say that neither of those things is the biggest health crisis that we are facing, and in fact, the biggest health crisis that we are facing is the climate crisis, well, they've just got it so far wrong, they should probably be shut down. If I had a copy of it, I'd probably rip it up, for heaven's sake. The BMJ. I think you need a new editor. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, you will already know that we are the fastest growing radio station on the planet. You will already know that we are talking about a massive influx of talent into the Talk Radio TV. You will already know that Piers Morgan is joining Talk TV and he's going to be doing shows as well. We're going to have all sorts of great things going on. And I'm delighted to be able to announce to you right now exclusively that we can add to the roster of great names, including Jeremy Kyle, including Julia Hartley Brewer, including, of course, James Whale, and all sorts of great contacts and people that you want to listen to and watch all the way through the day and all the way through the night. Rob Rinder is back after a successful stint as guest presenter in the Drive Time slot earlier this summer. Rob Rinder is now named by Talk Radio as the new permanent host of the Friday Drive Time show. So we'll be looking forward to talking to Rob about it all tomorrow. He's going to be announcing it and how his show is going to look, how it's going to be. You all loved him when he was here before. We wanted him back, and now we have got him back. And so we're very proud to announce that Danny Morris says Rob Rinder is a proven favourite with Talk Radio listeners and viewers of Talk Radio TV. His intelligence, warmth and wit will provide the perfect start to the weekend. So he kicks it all off this Friday, the 8th of October, 4 p.m. So don't miss it. We will talk to Rob coming up in the next 24 hours. And it's another great day to be at Talk Radio. It just gets better and better, doesn't it? Simon Calder, I'm sure, will approve. Simon, very good afternoon to you.
I got a bit worried there for a minute, Mike, because you said intelligence, warmth and wit.
Yes.
And I thought, crikey. And then you told me it was Rob. So that's great news.
Well, yes. Listen, you've got as long as you've got at least one of those qualities, Simon, and I think I can say that you do, at the very least, have one of them. You're always welcome with us.
Well, that's very nice of you. But look, here I am at the Group Leisure and Travel Show. Yes, it's an actual travel show with actual people going round, finding out about all the travel opportunities that are going on. And it's a remarkable throwback to the olden days, 2019, if you remember that, when we used to go on holiday quite a lot.
Yes.
And it's a sign, I think, a sign, Mike, that things aren't quite as bad as we thought they were, although they are changing at a rate of knots, and it's really quite difficult to keep tabs on what's happening
well,
now.
Well, it really is, isn't it? But I mean, I agree with you that we've seemed to have been of late taking more steps forward and no steps back, because I think what you and I will both agree that we had a terrible period where we'd sort of take one step forward and then two steps back, and in some place we'd go green and it would go amber, then it would go amber, then it would go red. You never quite knew what was going on.
But chucking in amber plus as well, what was all that about?
Yeah, well, I know. So do you get the sense that we are kind of settling down a little bit then?
Well, we've got some really interesting stuff from the government. So yesterday morning, 32 countries from Bangladesh to Ghana to Gambia to Malaysia were on the Foreign Office no-go list. They warned against all but non-essential travel, and basically the idea was that these places had such high coronavirus rates that they were too dangerous for you to go to, Mike. It was advice, it wasn't law, but suddenly by tea time they weren't too dangerous at all.
Marvelous.
Which was quite miraculous, and I'm not quite sure what happened to make it possible, but it certainly did. And that was all to do with aligning these two lists, because at the moment we've got one list called the no-go list, which is just Foreign Office saying we really don't want you to go there, Mike. And we've got the other list, which is the red list, which is, Mike, you've been to these countries, you are now going to go and sit in a quarantine hotel for 11 nights.
Right.
And we're going to throw away the key.
So forgive my ignorance here. So is the no-go list separate from the red list then?
Completely separate. And so a lot of people were just thinking, well, this is weird. You know, why if the Department for Transport says it's okay to go to Malaysia, does the Foreign Office say, oh, we don't want to go to Malaysia because of that COVID stuff?
Right.
And it just didn't make much sense. Still doesn't make much sense if you're talking about Jamaica, because that's on the all right to go to list, according to the Department for Transport, but the Foreign Office doesn't want you to go there. However, we are beginning to align these things. And at some time, it might be tea time. Who can tell, frankly? We are possibly going to get the news that suddenly anybody arriving today from one of the 54 countries on the red list is going to be hoiked straight into hotel quarantine, £2,285, please. But from sometime next week, the vast majority of those countries, you won't need to.
Right.
And this is all part of sort of dismantling the rules which are utterly, utterly disproportionate for the UK. We have the odd situation of having by far the highest infection rates of any major country in Europe, and by far the toughest rules to keep people from bringing in that coronavirus stuff.
Well, you see, the trouble is, it depends how you look at it, doesn't it? I mean, what we actually have are the highest number of positive tests of any country, because we also do the highest number of tests of any country. So I think we sort of shot ourselves slightly in the foot with that, but that's another argument for another time. So I'm still being rather thick here, because I can't quite work out whether you say that. So are you saying that all these 32 countries that were on the no-go list are now on the red list?
No. They're on the they're off the no-go list,
right,
and they are not on the red list, although some of them most certainly were, like Bangladesh,
right,
for example.
So you can go to all of them now, in other words.
Yeah, you could go to them anyway, because the Foreign Office was just advised, but it did have the unfortunate effect of meaning that, for example, your travel insurance wasn't valid.
I see.
And also, if you were a big tour operator like TUI,
yeah,
you wouldn't send people to a country where the Foreign Office says, oh, you don't want to go there.
No, I see. So you want to check both lists, in other words, if you're trying to go somewhere.
Yes, but they and lots of people are saying, hang on, we just don't get it. Why would the two lists be different? Well, there's perfectly good reasons why the Foreign Office, which is looking at the risk to you, Mike, of going to Outer Mongolia or wherever, you know, is Mike going to be okay? What's going to happen to him? And what are the possible threats?
Is he going to be taken hostage?
Well, yes, and anybody who suggests that we were crowdfunding that, I think, would be very, very unfair.
That would be unfair.
So it's perfectly reasonable for the Foreign Office to come up with a different conclusion than the Department for Transport, which is looking strictly as when Mike comes back from Outer Mongolia, is he going to bring in a variant of concern,
right,
for example?
Right.
So you would expect it to be different. But on the when it's the only thing that the Foreign Office is worried about is COVID-19, and they say, ooh, don't go to Jamaica, all that COVID stuff, it's nasty, you know. And the Department for Transport says, Jamaica, no problem at all. That people do not understand that, and I can understand them not understanding it.
You know, I think that used to be one of their travel industry slogans, didn't it? Jamaica, no problem. I think it was. I'm sure I saw it on a T-shirt when I was there.
Yes, or Island of Contrasts or something like that.
Yeah, but, I think I prefer mine, to be honest, but there we are. Now, what about Dubai? Because the last time you and I spoke, they were still trying to fix what was described as a technical problem with the double jabbed coming here from Dubai. Have they fixed that yet?
Yes, they have. So the United Arab Emirates, this is another of those extraordinary things where we do things differently from everybody else. So most countries say, okay, we expect visitors to be double jabbed, which is getting more and more kind of just the norm around the world. And there's obviously a discussion about whether what that means for people who can't or choose prefer not to be jabbed. But the UK says we expect you to be double jabbed. And by the way, we only trust jabs from, well, now it's 55 different countries, including the UAE.
Right.
But the vast majority of jabs administered worldwide, the UK does not recognise. And it is utterly baffling. I mean, if you take Pfizer-BioNTech, invented by a Turkish scientist, if you've had yours in Germany, that's fine. If you've had yours in Turkey, it's not fine.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same stuff pulsing around your veins.
Right.
But the UK says, oh, no, you're not coming in here with that. Or you are. But
well, you know, when this is all over, Simon, you should write a book about all of the various different sort of strange, bizarre decisions and sort of rules that were put into place that were completely contradictory and made no sense at all. I think it'd be a big seller.
Oh, well, I will. Yes, you can write the jokes for me, Mike.
Yeah, OK, then I will. Now, I've got a couple of questions for you from the good people listening. One is this from Andrew, who says, will you please ask this question to Simon Calder? If before you return from an overseas trip, you test positive and have to quarantine a hotel for 10 days, can you claim the cost back on your travel insurance?
Well, it all depends, and I'm sorry not to be more helpful, on what your travel insurance says. It also depends what your location is. So, for instance, in Greece, they say, sorry, we're going to hoik you off to a quarantine hotel, but we'll give you all your meals and so on, and sorry about that. Travel insurance policies will say, yes, if you test positive abroad, we will for COVID, we will cover your costs. And it all depends. Some countries, yes, you have to pay for the cost of it. Many you do not. And in terms of your flights getting home, generally airlines, holiday companies will say, okay, we understand you weren't able to take the flight because you were tested positive, but we will not charge you for changing. So actually, for a lot of the time, people who are in the extremely unfortunate position of testing positive while abroad, there won't actually be any great financial hit, although it will of course be unfortunate. But no need to test before flying home, so therefore a lot of the people who previously would have been caught, as it were, won't be, because they don't need to test to get on the plane back to Britain.
No, so most people that will not be affecting now, I'm hoping. Got another one here saying, could you please ask Simon about South Africa? Has it come off the red list?
No, but if by this stage, by tea time tomorrow, if it has not come off the red list, then I invite you, Mike, and your lovely listeners to come up with a forfeit for me to perform, because I cannot see any possible grounds for South Africa still being on the red list, and neither can South Africa, and neither, frankly, can anybody who's looked at the numbers, looked at the reality, and thought, well, hang on, so... we're worrying about a beta variant that was really alarming last December, but has now been completely obliterated by the famous Delta variant.
Yes, I remember that in the deep, dark vaults of history, the Delta variant.
Yes.
Everyone was very scared of it. Nathan in Portsmouth says this. Could you please ask Simon Calder about this? I'm a postal worker and have read on government website that postal workers don't need to isolate if they're coming from abroad. I've read that as unvaccinated, I still need to do tests, though. Now, this, I think, refers to the old-fashioned quarantine list from a long time ago. Do you remember when all sorts of people were on it, including people that worked for the BBC?
Yeah, and we have had that cleared up, I think, a while ago, Nathan. So yeah, what the rules mean is if you are kind of actively travelling abroad as part of your role, then you are given some leeway. But if it's simply that you do great work for the Postal Service or the NHS or whoever, but you happen to have been going on holiday because you want to go on holiday, reasonably enough, then I'm afraid there is no leniency for you at all. There has to be a purpose for you to be traveling, and just going on holiday, I'm afraid, doesn't cut it. You would need you would need the Royal Mail to say, Nathan, please go and fetch some important parcels from Paris or something.
Yes.
And in my experience, they're unlikely to do that, I'm afraid.
And what about the old Heathrow scenario yesterday? Because, funnily enough, my sister arrived from New York yesterday and had no problem whatsoever coming through Terminal 5. However, I was told by others that there were problems with the E-gates in some other parts of the airport.
Yes, and certainly there were problems early on, and I'm glad your sister was all right, because it tends to be early on. Flights start coming in from about 5.
Yeah, she came in about 10. So
by about... Oh, okay. Oh, good. She got a later flight out of New York, so she would have been all right. But there was a bit of a squeeze from sort of, 5, 6, 7, 8. Lots and lots of long waits, lots of unhappy people. I mean, nobody's actually going to be happy when you get off a plane and you're at Heathrow and it's raining and it's 5 o'clock in the morning. But people were unhappier than usual. Heathrow once again says, we're very sorry about this, but they point the finger at Border Force. It was difficult and uncomfortable for a lot of people, and I'm sorry about that. And it's a repeat of what we have seen, but I'm afraid the line from the government constantly is, you're going abroad, well, you're going to have to live with what, or you're coming into UK from abroad, these are difficult times, just put up with it.
Yeah, but I'm not accepting that, I'm afraid. I think that's an absolute abrogation of their responsibility, because, I mean, just because people are going abroad and there's still a bit of COVID knocking about doesn't mean the e-gate shouldn't work. I mean, that's nonsensical, isn't it? You might as well say, well, we can't make any coffee.
But if Mr. or Ms. e-gate mender is not well because of COVID and, 30,000 cases a day.
Oh, what, then, you mean all working from home because they don't want to come in, you mean, that sort of thing?
He or she is not able to get the things working, I would say.
Right. Funny how it seems to be mostly in the public sector, isn't it?
Well, yes.
You might say there's a pattern there. How about this one? Can you ask Simon how long these rip-off PCR tests are going to be in place for people who aren't jabbed? I need to get to my place in Spain. I've had COVID twice and have a current COVID passport, says Alex.
Oh, Alex, I'm so sorry you've had COVID twice, but just think of those antibodies. Right, and the short answer to your question is I haven't got a flipping clue. But that's only because it's not because I'm an idiot, although you might well think that. It's because I asked last night the Department for Health and Social Care what was going to be going on with that, because they have absolutely promised by the end of half term, for England and Wales, has to be said, not for Scotland, they are going to be coming up with a PCR test that will be ditched, and instead you'll be able to do lateral flow. Mm. But we're not quite sure, because it might mean this is was floated by kind of briefing or leaks from government yesterday to the Times. It might be that you get off the plane, you go home, you put the kettle on, and then you you film yourself shoving a swab up your nose,
yes,
so you can send it to Sajid Javid and say, "Here you are, mate," just to prove that I am.
Or you do it on a live video link, perhaps, which that's what my sister's got a deal with. Well, she came with American Airlines, and they've got a deal where she gets here and does the test on video before she goes back, basically.
And she's not going to do that on video for talk radio, is she? I mean, that would be...
Well, I don't think so. I don't think we're allowed to show medical interventions here unless you get special dispensation from Sajid Javid. Right. I think that's probably against all sorts of Ofcom rules. But what I can tell you is she's got something called Verifly, which is a very interesting app, which I don't know whether we have access to in this country, but it includes all of her passport information, flight information, boarding pass and vaccination stuff, so it's all on one app. But of course, what I can also tell you is that nobody asked for the locator form when she arrived at Heathrow. She just came wandering through.
Oh, sure, but that I don't have a problem with that, Mike, and I hope she didn't have a problem with it, because she's already been verified when she left the US, because American Airlines is not going to let her on that plane, even though she is your sister, until She has demonstrated, look, I've filled in the passenger locator form. Look, I've booked my PCR test.
Yeah.
So therefore, let me on the plane. So UK Border Force says, well, actually, we've got American Airlines to do all our work for us. So all we've got to do is actually just check that it is Mike's sister.
Yeah.
Once we've done that, then she can go off and
And
have
she's
a nice
far
time.
Far less troublesome than me anyway, Simon. So, you know, she doesn't normally run into these kind of problems with the officialdom of this country.
Yes.
Now, one from Joe. Off to Canada, hopefully on Wednesday. The testing regime is a nightmare. Do I need a test to come back? Do I need a day two? What the hell is going on? I think, like a lot of people, Joe's confused. I don't blame him.
Yeah, oh, well, Joe, what the heck is going on? Nobody knows, least of all me. No, the Canadians opened up on the 7th of November, 7th of September, I believe, and that seems to be going okay, to vaccinated travellers only. They do require a test before you go there. I believe it's PCR rather than lateral flow, but don't write in, just check. With the Canadians, they've got a good website which will tell you what's required. But coming back, you no longer need a test before you travel. What you will need is just to the usual old stuff of filling in the passenger locator form, quite possibly the most difficult form ever created by man.
I'm told. I've not tried, but I know people have said it takes about an hour and a half to do.
Yes, and there's just lots and lots of things to trip you up. And in order to do that, you've got to pre-book your PCR test. Mm. But Joe, it depends when you're coming back, because at some stage during October, that PCR test will magically turn into a lateral flow test. And more than anything else, I need to remind people, please do not book any tests any earlier than you absolutely have to, because you might regret it.
Okay.
For instance, Turkey, Friday tea time, suddenly said, tell you what, no PCR tests. And that was great. And it's really good and encouraging and everything. Unless you happen to be one of the people who've just spent 50 or 80 quid on a PCR test because you're going to go to Turkey.
Yes, quite. Well, final one from Isabella. Would you please ask Simon if he thinks we'll be able to use the free lateral flow test at the end of October, ready for the half-term break? Or will we have to purchase them if lateral flow from a private test centre?
Well, the absolute assumption is lateral flow can, if you're using it for the purposes of travel, you have to buy it privately. So, yes, you're going to have to pay for it. The only exceptions are traveling to and from Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK and traveling between Scotland and its islands, where the governments in those countries have said, we want people to test and you can use your NHS test. But under any other circumstances, nope, it's a proper test with a proper medical certificate, and you're going to be paying for it, I'm afraid.
Yes, well, you know, whichever way you cut it, we always end up paying for it, don't we? Whether it's through tax, or whether it's through test, or whether it's through some kind of repaying of the government loan that they took from us at some point. But Simon, very helpful. Thank you very much as ever. And we've had already Jim pointing out that he really enjoyed it when you said something and the whole crowd behind you applauded. Which was rather good. So well done. First time I think you've ever got a round of applause for saying something on talk radio. But who knows? That could become a thing. Maybe we'll do some live shows. You never know what's going to happen with talk radio. What I can tell you is that Rob Rinder is joining us for the Friday Drive Time show as of this Friday, i.e. tomorrow.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing.
Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.